We turn for our reading this evening to the Old Testament, turn to the book of Ruth, and we read together the first chapter. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. The man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name Naomi. The names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you as you have shown to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them, and they wept aloud and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me." At this they wept again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. When I told my wife that we would be starting a series on Ruth, her response, in jest I do hasten to add, was, "Ruth for a mixed group. Surely that's for women's groups." I do tell that with permission. But that is the response, of course, of many. Isn't Ruth a book for women? Women's Bible studies study Ruth, but, well, not men's groups. Congregation, surely that's a bit odd. To many people, of course, the book of Ruth, the centre of it's a story of the romantic love between Ruth and Boaz. Isn't that what the book's about? And in that understanding, Ruth, in a way, is a kind of Old Testament Mills and Boone romantic short story. Isn't that what the book is about. It's not the kind of book to interest men, surely. It's about Ruth and how she got herself a husband and all of that. Isn't that really what the story is about? A book, yes, to be studied in women's groups, but not often among men, though in our defence, I would say our central Bible study some years ago went through the book of Ruth, I trust, profitably. But if that is the case, if that really is the nature of the book of Ruth, you might well ask then, what's it doing in our Bibles? Is it just a nice wee story in the middle of the Bible? What is the point of it? Yes, there are perhaps some examples regarding godly, healthy relationships, but there are other things in it that in our culture seem decidedly odd and that we wouldn't be perhaps commending to, for example, our young folk as they might think of marriage in the future. But yes, there is more to the book of Ruth. There's a great deal more to the significance of this book. It has a significant place in the canon of Scripture. We've often asked in the history books, when we were studying Judges and earlier when we looked at Genesis, asking the question, well, where is this going? What's the goal of this historical record? And we can ask the same with regard to the book of Ruth. Where is this going? And we don't have to wonder, because in chapter 4 and verse 22 we are told that she was an ancestor of King David. And beyond that, of course, beyond David, we have David's greater son. We have the Messiah. Ruth has a part in the genealogy of the Messiah, of the Lord Jesus Christ. And that means she has a place in the unfolding of the divine plan of salvation. So this may be a small book, but it has big significance. And that's what we'd be seeking to bring out as we work our way through the four chapters of this book. What is at the heart of the book of Ruth is not the romance of Ruth and Boaz. At the heart of the book of Ruth is another stage in the unfolding of the eternal plan of salvation that's leading us to the Lord Jesus Christ. And if we miss that, we haven't understood what Ruth is about. At the center of Ruth is the purpose of God and ultimately the Messiah. Very interesting. I was looking at a Jewish Christian study Bible recently for the book of Ruth. And the whole of the comments on Ruth, and this was, say, from a Jewish Christian perspective, the Messiah was never mentioned. I find that almost incredible that that was the case, because that's to miss the heart of the book of Ruth. But so it was. We'll try not to repeat that mistake. I want to look at chapter 1 of Ruth this evening, and we've entitled our study, The Hand of Providence. The Hand of Providence. We look at the opening chapter of the book. The first thing we see is a fearful flight. A fearful flight. Opening words, in the days when the judges ruled, or when the judges judged, to be slightly more precise. And we've seen in recent weeks what exactly the days of the judges were like. They were, at many points during those centuries, horrendous days. Dark days, often of deep spiritual decline. And you think of the different episodes that we've looked at through the book of Judges. Even of the last study in Judges, we thought of Micah. Here is a man among the covenant people of God, yet he makes idols. He has a shrine. He hires really a kind of renegade Levite to be his priest. And you just see the utterly debased attitude to the God of Israel and the religion of Israel. And that, of course, worked itself through in all kinds of ways in the society of the day. You think of the violence of some of the atrocities in the latter chapters of Judges particularly. A great deal of bloodshed there. That was the days of the judges. So Ruth is set in those dark days. And we might say, against that very dark background, the light that we have in Ruth shines all the more clearly by way of contrast. The judges, the days of the judges were characterized, you'll remember, by a cycle of unfaithfulness on the part of Israel. That would be met by God's chastening. Often it would be by handing them over to their enemies until they learned that they had failed God, they'd been unfaithful to God, they repented, and God would send a judge to deliver them. And we saw how regularly that pattern was repeated. It seemed as if one generation didn't learn from the earlier generation. Again and again, unfaithfulness, chastening, eventually repentance, and the giving of a judge, a deliverer, in the days when the judges judged. There was a famine in the land, is the next thing we read in verse 1. And that might well fit in the days of Gideon. We can't be sure. We're not given any indications in Ruth precisely when these events took place. But it would fit the days of Gideon. Cast your mind back to Judges 6 when we looked at Gideon there. The oppressors at that time were the Midianites, eastern people. And we're told, for example, in Judges 6 and verse 4, the Midianites camped on the land and ruined the crops. That seemed to be an annual pattern. The Midianites would come and just destroy everything in Israel. And that might well account for a time of famine. Yes, it could be because of lack of rain, something like that. The harvest failed. But I think the days of the judges make it much more likely it was because of the depredations of the Midianites or whoever else. And you remember what Gideon was doing the first time that we met him in Judges 6:11. He was threshing wheat in the winepress to keep it from the Midianites. So it was a time of great shortage in Israel because of the invasions of the Midianites. It may well be that Ruth is set in those particular days, but it doesn't matter. If we needed to know, the Lord would have told us. But that gives us the background to the account we have in chapter 1 of Elimelech from Bethlehem. A man from Bethlehem went to live for a while in the country of Moab. It's Elimelech and his family, his wife Naomi, and his two sons move in this time of scarcity, time of famine, to the neighbouring territory of Moab. And there, we're told, they settle for a time. After Elimelech's death, the sons will marry Moabite women. They move to the territory of Moab, where in the legal views of the time, they would be resident aliens. Same if Moabites had moved to Israel and so on. They were temporary residents. They would have certain basic rights. So Elimelech and his family from Bethlehem move for the time being. They don't perhaps know how long it would be, into the territory of Moab. What are we to make of that? Well, on the one hand, we might well say, well, what would you expect them to do? After all, it's perfectly understandable. It's a time of famine. The man has a duty to provide for his family while there's such a shortage in Israel. Why wouldn't he move to Moab? Was it not probably a very wise thing to do? No food in Israel, so he goes where there is food. And it might even seem a commendable step for Elimelech to take. But there's another side to what we read here. Does the flight not perhaps suggest to us a lack of faith on Elimelech's part? He went, others didn't go. Interesting that his name Elimelech means "my God is king." Of course, names were significant in the Old Testament. Parents would give them, perhaps as a statement of faith or their hopes for the children who bore that particular name. "My God is King." Might we not expect from a man among the covenant people of God who bore a name like that to exhibit a greater degree of trust in the God of Israel? Should his name not in practice have been a testimony of faith. My God is King. How much trust in this God is he demonstrating when he takes the family to the territory of Moab? Should he not have been trusting the God of the covenant to provide for his people? In the law in Leviticus 26, for example, there were the promises that God made to faithful, obedient Israelites, and among them were provision of harvest, of food, of necessities. But of course, that's a key, isn't it? Provision for faithful Israelites, covenant keepers. And later on in Leviticus 26, there are the curses on those who are unfaithful and who are covenant breakers. And that reminds us of the root of the problem in Israel. The most likely reason why there was a famine, why they didn't have food, it was because, as so often in the days of the judges, they were unfaithful to the God of the covenant. Had the people been faithful, there's every likelihood that there would have been the supply that God had promised. There would have been a sufficiency. And think of where he goes. He goes to Moab, a pagan country. It's very significant that in the law, Deuteronomy 23, Moabites were excluded from the congregation of Israel to the 10th generation. That's a very eloquent statement about how the God of Israel viewed the Moabites and their religion. Very significant. Not only that, but again, you turn back to the book of Judges, and you see in Judges 3, account of Eglon of Moab, who came and who oppressed Israel for 18 years, until eventually Ehud, the judge, assassinated him. 18 years oppression at the hands of the king of Moab. What is Moab then to an Israelite? It ought to be a place of idolatry, of false religion, and indeed of political enmity. And Elimelech moves his family to a pagan country, an enemy country. And we've got to ask, how far is that expressing the faith of his name, My God is King? It's not really the action of a man who in any serious way thinks of God as King. And remember, of course, there were many. Suppose it's the days of Gideon. There were many who didn't go to Moab, who stayed in Israel, in the covenant land. And God eventually delivered them from famine, from enemies, through a judge. So Elimelech's action at one level might seem quite understandable when we probe it a bit more and we think of what it says spiritually about Elimelech. We see it does express a lack of faith, a failure of trust in the God of the covenant, that this is where he goes. And so Ruth, the book of Ruth, doesn't start off in a very encouraging way. It's the days of the judges. It's a day of spiritual decline. And surely here is just one example on a very individual level of that kind of spiritual decline. And yet, God, in his grace, is at work in what seems at first a very unpromising situation. We see a situation of failure, of a lack of trust and faith, and yet God is working. And so it brings us to think in the second place of a daunting return. A daunting return. We're focused on Elimelech to begin with as we thought of the fearful flight. And it was very likely that Naomi, his wife, had perhaps little or no input to the decision to move. We don't know. But as we think now of a daunting return, the focus turns to Naomi. What we see about her, what we learn about this significant woman. I think of her circumstances. Elimelech dies. Then her two sons marry Moabite wives. Then they die. And after 10 years, there's Naomi left with two daughters-in-law, no men in the family. Very hard situation. It would be hard in a modern-day setting, but if we project back to the days of the judges, 3,000 years ago, the plight of Naomi is terrible. There she is as a widow in a foreign country, extremely vulnerable position. Widows in general were vulnerable in that culture. You think of how often in the Old Testament, in the law, the commands were to care for who? The widow, the orphan, the stranger. The three most vulnerable groups in that society. And if widows were vulnerable in their own community in Israel, we can only guess how vulnerable Naomi would have been in Moab, where she had nobody of significance, no males certainly, to care for her, to defend her. Anything could have happened. She's in a very vulnerable position. If we think of the daughters-in-law, Orpah and Ruth, what of their situation? Well, they start out with Naomi to go to Bethlehem. But again, you look at their circumstances, it's hard not to conclude there's very, very little for them in Bethlehem. They go back, they are foreigners. The attitude of the people of Bethlehem to Moabites is unlikely to be terribly friendly. We've said they were the enemy. Not all that long ago, people would certainly be able to think back to, well, what did the Moabites do to us? And there's a couple of them here. What do we want them eating our food, if not taking our jobs? They're unlikely to meet with a very positive reception. What prospects have they of any kind of a decent life if they stay with Naomi? On the face of it again, they'd be far better to stay in their own culture. There'd be no further sons in the family for them to marry. Stay in their own culture, find Moabite husbands, go back to their own homes. It seems they both still have families to go back to. It's not that they're left with nobody. They could go back to their families. And when Naomi says to them, return home, it does seem good advice. And Orpah takes that advice, verse 14. She goes back home, and many would say, well, you couldn't blame her. There's not much to be hoped for if she goes on with Naomi. But that isn't the whole story, of course. We know that. Because the central figure of the book of Ruth is not Ruth, nor Boaz, nor Naomi. The central character, if we can call him that, is the Lord. The heart of the book of Ruth is the Lord and what he does and how he works out his purpose. Verse 6 is significant. It says of Naomi, she had heard that the Lord had visited his people. That's how the ESV puts it. Had visited his people and given them food. Very significant. 10 years in Moab. But Naomi's faith has not been destroyed. It hasn't been worn down. You still see her as a woman of faith. Faith in the Lord, in the God of the covenant. And she hears the good news, by whatever means, from the home country. God has acted in covenant mercy to deliver his people. That word visited is a significant word. There are a number of important words, as we'll see here, that keep coming back in the book of Ruth that are very significant and taking us to its central message. God had visited his people. The word that's used sometimes in the Old Testament could mean God visits in judgment. Sometimes God visiting was a terrible thing. But in circumstances like this, God visiting is a wonderful thing. It's a gracious thing. God, the God of the covenant, comes to his people. And he comes to bring blessing in whatever form it's needed. and the famine, deliverance from enemies, that God had visited his people Israel, is the language, we could say, of believing hope. And that's what was in Naomi's heart at this point. It was believing hope. God had visited his people, and so there's hope. There is encouragement. There's good reason to go back to the covenant land, back in particular to Bethlehem. How curious that Bethlehem means house of bread. Well, there's bread in Bethlehem. And Naomi knows God is at work. And so it's the Lord who is at the heart of the record. And Naomi, as a woman of faith, understands that God is working. Here's something to encourage her in these extremely difficult circumstances. And two things in particular that strike us. The first is Naomi's God. This brings us back again to the fact God's at the center of this book. Naomi's God. Notice the words in verses 8 and 9 to her daughters-in-law. Some key words in those verses. May the Lord show kindness to you. Very significant. It's the language of covenant love. God's love to utterly undeserving people. If, in a way, that there's one characteristic of the God of the Old Testament, this is it. The God of covenant love. Love to those who deserve judgment. A God who provides deliverance for his people. And he will provide deliverance through a redeemer. Now, the word redeemer isn't used here, but it will be when we get to chapter 2. And a redeemer is crucial to understanding what happens in the rest of the book of Ruth. That's where Boaz comes in very significantly. But the God of kindness, the God of covenant love, is a God who provides deliverance through a redeemer. Then Naomi goes on, may the Lord grant that you will find rest. And there's another word to underline. Kindness is one significant word. Rest is another. Rest not in the sense of idleness, nothing to do, as we might use the term, but rest has great theological significance in the Old Testament. Rest is the gift of God, a gift that he gives to his covenant people. God is a God who provides rest. Israel were given rest in the promised land. And it is not just social or political or economic. Fundamentally, rest is something spiritual. When God gives rest to people, it is first and foremost rest of soul. It's spiritual rest. It's what God gives his people through the Messiah. And that's picked up in the New Testament, the book of Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 4. And there in Hebrews 4 we are told that there remains a rest for God's people, that finally we will enjoy in glory. And that's the language that Hebrews uses. And it's taken from the Old Testament. God gives rest. Rest, first of all, for the soul. It is something profoundly spiritual. And so Naomi, in these words to her daughters-in-law, is using the language of faith. She's speaking to them of her trust in a God of grace. Grace that shows itself in providential care for people like her. For his faithful people. Kindness and rest. Those are very important and very encouraging words as Naomi thinks of her God. What kind of a God is he? He's a faithful covenant God a God of kindness, and a God who gives rest to his people, full of encouragement. Naomi's God. But yes, we also have to see here Naomi's pain. And we can't skate over that or read this with rose-tinted spectacles. She is a woman in an extremely hard situation. And we've talked about this return, that it is daunting, and it is. The realities of what is ahead for her, and she knows that. What she's been through and what she may still be facing. Naomi's faith doesn't mean that somehow she's free from pain, from loss, from trial. Naomi's not somebody who believes the prosperity gospel, you know. If you've enough faith, you know, you'll not be sick, you'll not be poor, you'll not be anything unpleasant. No, Naomi knows better than that. Yes, she's a woman of faith, but the trials are real. And she uses strong language in describing her circumstances. She puts it very bluntly there in verse 13, "It is more bitter for me because the Lord's hand has gone out against me." Isn't that a very powerful description of the difficulties of her circumstances? Yes, she knows it's the Lord's hand. That's the voice of faith. "But the Lord's hand has gone out against me, and it's bitter." There's a play on her name. Naomi means pleasant, and she says, "Call me Mara," which means bitter. And there is that sense of a woman who has gone through hardships and may well have to go through more hardships as she looks to the future. She knows the pain is within God's providence. She's not in any doubt about that. She talks about the Lord and about the Almighty. Her faith is there. It's not destroyed. But nevertheless, the pain is great. And as yet, she doesn't understand the purpose of it. She doesn't know why God is leading her on a very hard road. This is often the situation of God's people. God leads us on a hard road many, many times. We don't know where it's going. And we don't know why God is taking us by that route. Sometimes we do, but not often. And that's Naomi's situation. She knows this is God's providence. She knows the Lord's hand is directing events, but it is hard. It is bitter. Verse 21, "Likewise, the Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." She's not dressing it up in pretty colors. This is tough. And for all she knows, it may get tougher. And she's facing the reality of it. And God's people are not to be pretenders. Sometimes, you know, Christians feel they can't admit pain. They can't admit hardship because maybe that's letting God down. And somehow they feel they're sort of keeping God's stock up if they pretend everything is okay when it isn't. But there are times when it isn't all right and it is hard. And we don't understand what God and his providence is doing. We have no idea where he's taking us and why it has to be by this route. We may, like Naomi, be quite sure that it's God who's doing it. But there are times when it is very hard and there's no virtue in pretending. Think of some of the Psalms. We sang from Psalm 73. The first part of the Psalm is the Psalm just crying out, "I don't understand why this is happening," particularly for him, the prosperity of the ungodly. And there are times when those Psalms are particularly appropriate, when we don't understand what God's doing. And so it is for Naomi. Yes, this is within God's sovereign providence, but Christ warned us, John 16, 33, "In the world you will have tribulation." We have many of the trials that every human being has to endure. Plus, as God's people, there's the whole dimension of spiritual warfare. And we have to bear that, and sometimes it is very hard. And for Christians, pain is pain, just as much for any unsaved person. And it's no virtue to pretend that it isn't. So it is a daunting return. There is the precious reality of Naomi's God, a God who's sovereign, a God of covenant kindness, a God who gives rest, but Naomi's pain is real too. She doesn't pretend otherwise. A fearful flight, a daunting return. And then finally, a gracious commitment. Gracious commitment. Here's our first sight of Ruth. And evidently, Naomi's witness in Moab has borne fruit. Here is the fruit of Naomi's witness to the God of Israel. And those words that have become famous in verses 16 and 17 are a profound commitment that Ruth is making. It has life-changing significance. Nothing will be the same for Ruth in the future. And here is an expression of what it's going to mean for her. Don't urge me to leave you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people. Your God, my God. That is a very precious expression of her commitment. Where you go, I will go. Where will that be? Bethlehem, foreign country, maybe hostile territory. Who knows what's waiting for her when she gets there? People might be happy to see Naomi back, but they might not want her daughter-in-law. She can't be sure. Your people will be my people. Well, will Naomi's people want her as part of their community? And she's leaving behind life, family, potentially security. She's leaving behind, in a way, everything to go with Naomi. New family, new culture. What lies ahead? She doesn't know. And the crucial statement surely is, your God will be my God. That's the heart of what Ruth is saying. Yes, it is a warm-hearted, loving commitment to Naomi. It certainly is that. But at a deeper level, the most important level, it's a spiritual commitment to the God of Naomi, the God of the covenant, the God of Israel. Fundamentally, Ruth's commitment is a spiritual commitment. She uses the language Naomi uses of the Lord, the covenant God, the God who took a people to be his own, a God who gives himself to them in the covenant. I will be your God and you will be my people. And Ruth uses the language of the Lord. He is her covenant God, her acceptance of God as her God. She commits herself to God and to his people. And the gods of Moab are left behind. They have no part in Ruth's life any longer. They are in the past. They're gone. There's no allegiance, no commitment to the gods of Moab. It's the God of the covenant, the Lord. It's an expression of faith. And I've called it a gracious commitment for a reason. It's a gracious commitment, not simply because it is very warm and polite, but it's gracious because it's the fruit of God's grace. It's in that sense that it's a gracious commitment. It's the fruit of the grace of God in Ruth's heart and life. It's a confession of faith, really, that she is making here. Faith in the living God, the covenant God, the God of Israel. And it's grace that's brought her to this point. It's not something she's achieved or worked up in herself. God's grace has touched her heart and life. Ruth believes in the Lord for the same reason that Lydia in the New Testament in Acts 16 believed. Why? The Lord opened her heart. That is exactly what God has done for Ruth. in Moab, in that pagan environment. Well, there's perhaps only one believing woman there with her, and yet the grace of God touched and changed her. And she is committed by grace to the Lord. The Lord has opened her heart. Isn't that amazing? In the dark days of the judges, so much spiritual decline, so much ungodliness, immorality, and yet in the middle of all of that, here is gospel hope. You remember as we went through Judges from time to time, we looked for and we found flashes of gospel light. Well, here is gospel light. It's not just a flash. It's radiant. Powerful revelation of the grace of God that could take a woman in a pagan country and touch and change her and make her his child, acknowledging him as her Lord. Gracious commitment. Grace from start to finish. And of course, that's always the case when a sinner is saved. It's true of us. If you're saved tonight, the only reason for that is the grace of God. You could have been brought up in the most godly home, church going, taken to Sabbath school from you were no age, taught, trained, all the rest of it. But none of that saved you. As Paul puts it in Ephesians 2:8, by grace you have been saved through faith. And it is never any different for any sinner. There's no other way into the kingdom. There's no back door. The only door is the grace of God. And that's what Ruth experienced. That's what Naomi had experienced. And God held on to her through the 10 years in Moab. And he'd continue to hold on to her as he'd hold on to Ruth and work out his purpose in her and through her. Marvelous purpose beyond anything she could have imagined, though she understands it now. And so Ruth 1 is full of encouragement. It begins in darkness, and decline and unfaithfulness, but it ends with the grace of God displayed clearly and beautifully. A gracious commitment, a life that was changed. In a dark place, in dark days, the grace of God shines brightly, as it still does.